Okay, so we are beginning our series of shiurim called Tricks, Loopholes, and Legal Fictions. Does the halacha allow us to deceive God? So Steve just asked if it's a yes or no question, and of course, as with all questions that we answer, the answer is yes and no. So that's why we have to have four parts and with a variety of sources for each part. So I just wanted to, before we even look at the sheets, before we get into the substance of what we're going to be talking about, I wanted to give a couple of words of introduction. First of all, why this topic now? So I mentioned a couple of times that it's related to the fact that this is a Shemitah year, right? This year on Rosh Hashanah, we start. It's the seventh year in the agricultural cycle. So in Israel, it's a Shemitah year. And Shemitah, in theory, means that all agricultural activity in Israel is meant to stop for the year. And what that means, in fact, is that everybody tries to figure out over the course of the year how a farmer is going to work, how are people going to deal with their gardens, etc., etc. You know, all of those things. So in other words, as lofty and as important as Shemitah is as a concept, what it's actually become over, and not now, not in the last century, but really for centuries, Shemitah has become an occasion for trying to figure out every conceivable way around the Torah's restrictions and the Torah's insistence that the land not be worked during the course of that year. And so the question is always, of course, when you say not, well, what does no really mean? Does no mean no, or does no mean we have to find a way around the no? So the last session that we do here is going to be devoted to Shemitah. Again, I divided it into four parts. The first part tonight is an introduction. We're just going to sort of try to get down some of the vocabulary and some framework for trying to think about this topic and look at some of the historical cases that sort of form the basis of the discussion. And then what I basically did was divide it into three parts chronologically, dealing with three questions, each question dealing with a different era in Jewish history and the question that came up during that era, except that these are all questions that are still relevant. So tonight we're going to do the introduction. The second session, next week, we're going to talk about the Prus Bowl. So the Prus Bowl is also a Shemitah question because in addition to telling us to avoid agriculture during the Shemitah year, the Torah also says that at the conclusion of the Shemitah year, all debts are canceled. Now, again, the question is, when you say that all debts are canceled, what do you really mean? Right? That's, of course, the obvious question that we ask when we hear a halacha like that. And the Prus Bowl is a famous device that kind of helps work around that issue. So next week we're going to look at that. Now why I'm putting that chronologically, because the Prus Bowl was devised in the ancient period. Hillel cooked that up. So that's going to be our first question. The second issue that we look at is going to be the sale of chametz. The sale of chametz, again, it originates in the time of the Mishnah, but it really starts getting cooking in the late Middle Ages, the early modern period, due to certain economic factors that the Jews had to deal with at that time. So that's going to be our second session, sort of late medieval, early modern period, and the questions that came up there, but again, still a relevant question. And the third session that we're going to look at is the one that deals with the agricultural questions during Shemitah, which really came to a head in the last 120 years or so, ever since the Jews started moving back to Israel and establishing modern agriculture in the land of Israel. And the question became, how do we deal with the question of Shemitah under those circumstances? So again, so we have basically what amounts to an ancient question, a, let's call it, early modern question, and a contemporary question that's only been relevant for 100 years or so, but all the questions are still relevant today. So that's why we're going to look at those. So that's why I organized it the way I did. And like I said, each one of those things is going to be fundamentally a halachic question, but it's also going to introduce us to some history, some social issues, the way that Jews lived, and the way that the issues that Jews encountered, again, whether it be socially or economically, during a variety of time periods. So it's interesting in that sense when we could sort of put everything together and see how the halacha speaks to the circumstances of the Jewish people at a specific time. So that's the structure of what we're going to be doing over these four sessions. Tonight we're just going to start, like I said, with an introduction and trying to get down some of the ideas and some of the terms and the phrases. That's number one. And that's why we're doing it now, because of the whole Shemitah connection. Important introduction number two, before we kind of dive into the issues, is to understand that this is a massive topic. Just to give you an idea, in the last, 5-6 years or so, a woman who originated in Teaneck wrote a dissertation in Columbia that's over 300 pages, just devoted to sort of part of what we're going to be doing tonight. One aspect of what we're going to be looking at over the course of these shiurim. Just the way sort of deal the more ancient sources deal with these questions, and not even getting into the medieval or the modern or like these historical and social issues. Just looking at the Gemaras and the Midrashim and the Tanaic sources, the Amoraic sources, and the Bavli, Yerushalmi. So if 300 pages could be written on that, you can imagine that this is a massive, massive topic. And so we're not really going to do it justice in the course of four shiurim. And tonight, what we're going to really be doing with this intro is even less justice. Again, like I said, tonight our goal is just to familiarize ourselves with the general issue and to sort of get down some of the terminology, some of the frameworks, some of the ideas. And then over the other shiurim, we're going to look at little snapshots of the broader issue and to see how, over time, these questions about deceiving God, quote-unquote, about finding loopholes within the halacha, come into play and help the Jews arrive at certain decisions halachically over time. That's just intro number two, is to understand that we're in no way going to be really doing justice to the issue, but we're going to be getting down, like I said, a snapshot and some basic framework for thinking about it. Number three, just for what it's worth, is that a loophole and a legal fiction are not the same thing, but we're going to be kind of converging them for the purpose of our discussion, because ultimately our question is really one of tricks. Different like ways of getting around keeping the halacha in its purest sense. So I kind of put together loopholes and legal fictions, even though technically they're not entirely the same thing. They're very, very closely related. Yeah.
Does it also extend to the current times where we have companies that find ways to circumvent Shabbos?
So that's an interesting question. Ben, what
was that? Was my question too. If you're going to bring it to modern times technology, like the Shabbos app.
So that's an interesting question. Okay, I knew that there was no way to avoid the question of the Shabbos app for this discussion, but I think we'll answer the question of the Shabbos app, maybe even over the course of tonight's discussion, and we'll see that, again, of course it's a bigger question than just the technicalities of the loopholes, which we'll see, again, like I said, in tonight's discussion, that it's always a bigger question than just the technicality. So we're going to touch on it, we're going to look at it. Some of the things that we're going to talk about tonight, again, kind of get to it. Because really, again, modern times, beyond just the Shemitah, again, my example for modern times is going to be the Shemitah question. We could try to throw in some other stuff, because you have in Israel today a whole institute that's devoted to studying the halacha and its interaction with technology and trying to come up with ways that, again, not just for people to text on Shabbos, but for, sorry? Right, the most famous thing that we see in America are these Machon Tzomet wheelchairs. What you don't see as much in America, but which is hidden away in certain places, are Machon Tzomet microphones that exist in certain shuls that may have somewhere in their bima hidden a microphone that works through certain halachic loopholes, if you will, certain halachic tricks. But Machon Tzomet, this institute that's devoted to the study of halacha and technology, they've come up with a lot of these things. They've come up with a lot of these different devices and things that can be used, particularly when it comes to Shabbos. And questions of, you know, how could a doctor write on Shabbos? Soldiers who have to drive on Shabbos, and so on and so forth, trying to at least minimize the amount of melacha that's done on Shabbos. So maybe as we proceed, we'll look at some of those things. So tonight we're not going to look at them, but it's a big question that really comes to it talks to the question of halacha interacting with the modern world, and the question of how far we want to go, right? And that's going to be part of what we talk about tonight. In other words, when you have these, you know, people who are developing ways of making technology work on Shabbos, so how far a leap is it from making an electric wheelchair that somebody could use on Shabbos to get around? How far a leap is that to the Shabbos app? Is that a big leap? Well, we'll have to see as we go along that it might be. It might be a big leap. It also might not. The question is really, when it comes to all of these devices that we're going to be talking about, these halachic devices, is it just the device itself that's important? Is it just the ability to circumvent the halacha, to circumvent the law, that allows us to do so? Or does it have to be more than just the ability, just finding the loophole? And by the way, it's not really just a discussion in halacha. You know, it's a discussion in legal ethics in general, right? You talk about tax law. Right, when people talk about should companies be allowed to come up with tax shelters, offshore tax havens, or incorporate. I was just looking, when I was doing some research for this, I discovered that apparently Apple created some, incorporated in, where was it?
Ireland,
yeah, right? And somehow, but in Ireland has a law that if your company doesn't function, isn't operated out of Ireland, then you don't have to pay their taxes. And so they pulled in billions of dollars without having to pay taxes, right? And there are discussions in all kinds of media. Okay, so they did it. And apparently it's legal, but is it ethical? Well, okay, fine. If you could ask that about tax law, you could ask that about all kinds of legal questions. And that's really, when it comes to halacha, the question of is it ethical is not just a technicality, and it's not just about ethics, but the question is, well, the question that we're going to try to figure out is, what is the question? What is the question that allows us to decide if these loopholes are okay or if they're not okay? By the end of tonight, I hope that we have some approach to answering that question. What are the factors? And then we'll be able to go look at the bigger issues. So let's do that. Let's dive into some of the material. So what I did is like this. I divided it into, the first section is called halachically sanctioned tricks, and the second section is tricks not sanctioned by halacha, and then we're going to try to figure out what they're all about. Now, the first couple of examples that we're going to give are going to seem a little esoteric, but we're going to see as we go along, certainly the first example is important for our understanding of the framework and for answering some of those questions about when is it okay to employ a loophole, when is it not okay to employ a loophole. So the first source that we're going to deal with is the question of Ma'aser Sheni. Ma'aser Sheni is this. It's a tithe that had to be brought to Yerushalayim. There are different kinds of tithes that are given from our produce, right? When people, back in the days when in Israel, people were living primarily agriculture, even not when everybody was living that way, but in general, when it comes to agriculture in Israel, there are different kinds of gifts or tithes that has to be separated from the food, right? We have what's called truma that had to be given to the Kohen. We had maaser that had to be given to the Levi. Then there was maaser sheni, which is what we're going to talk about here. There's maaser ani, a tithe that has to be given to the poor. It's tzedakah that is given periodically, not every year. So there are all kinds of different, right, challah, and all kinds of different things that are meant to be given from the produce of the Jewish farmer. Now, maaser sheni is interesting, because maaser sheni is not given to somebody else. Unlike truma or maaser that are given to the Kohen or to the Levi, maaser sheni is eaten by the owner of the farm. If I have a farm and I produce whatever it is, wheat field, I could take my wheat and I could bring it to Yerushalayim and I could eat it there. That's what is meant to be done with maaser sheni. It's meant for me to enjoy it, but to enjoy it in Yerushalayim. Without getting into all the details as to why that is, but let's look at what the Torah says. So the Torah introduces this institution of maaser sheni to us. This is from the Torah reading that we read on some of the Chagim. It says, Aser ta aser es kol tu asarecha, hayotzei asadeh shana shana. You shall tithe all of the produce of your field that is produced by your field each and every year. What do you do with that tithe? V'achalta lefnei Hashem elokecha b'makom asher yivchar l'shaken shemo sham. You'll eat it in the presence of Hashem your God, in the place that God has chosen to dwell, for His name to dwell there. Masar degancha tiroshcha v'yitzarecha. This is the tithe of your grains and your wine and your oil. L'v'charos b'karcha v'tzonecha. And the firstborn of your cattle and of your sheep. L'man tilmad liras Hashem elokecha kol hayamim. In order that you will learn to fear Hashem your God always. In other words, the Torah says the purpose of the Maaser Sheni is for you to go to Yerushalayim and to be in the presence of God so that some of your produce will be eaten around God so you understand the relationship between the human being and God. Now, the question is, what happens if a person lives at a distance from Yerushalayim? Let's say I grow some kind of perishable fruit, and well, let's say grapes, for argument's sake, right? And the grapes, and I live somewhere in the north of Israel. And by the time I get to Yerushalayim on my, with my donkey and my cart, the grapes are not going to be doing very well. What do I do now? Do I bring those to Yerushalayim? So the Torah says, no, you don't. This is the third pasuk in that first source. V'chir b'mimcha haderech ki lo tuchal se'eto. But if it's too long and you can't carry all that stuff, kirchak b'mcha makom asher yivchar Hashem elokecha lasum shemo sham, if the place that Hashem has chosen is too far away for you, ki yivarecha Hashem elokecha, when the Lord your God shall bless you. In other words, in theory, what this means is Hashem will bless you by expanding the borders of Israel, by making Israel larger so that people could live at further and further distances from Yerushalayim. And the further you go from Yerushalayim, the harder it is to bring your fruit to Yerushalayim, to bring your maaser sheni to Yerushalayim to eat it there. So what do you do? The Torah says there's a solution to that problem. We don't force you to carry all those grapes all of that distance. So what do you do? The Torah says, again, this is the fourth pasuk, v'natata b'kesef. It says here, you shall turn it into money. Turn it into money essentially means you exchange the value of the produce for money. Right? That's essentially what it means. In halacha, we call that pidyon. Pidyon literally means redemption, and it essentially means exchanging the value of one thing for money. So, and then what do? V'tzarta kesef biyadcha, you take that money in your hand, v'halachta el hamakom asher yivchar Hashem elokecha bo, and you go to the place that Hashem your God has chosen. Then it continues. V'natata hakesef b'chol asher ta'aveh nafshecha, and when you get to Yerushalayim, you use that money for anything that you want. Ba'bakar, ba'tzon, you could buy meat, ba'yayin, ba'shechar, you could buy drinks, b'chol asher t'shalcha nafshecha, whatever it is that your heart desires, v'achalta Hashem lefnei Hashem elokecha, v'samachta ato v'techa, eat and rejoice. That's what the Torah says. So again, in theory, Maser Sheni is meant to be brought to Yerushalayim. If you can't bring the Maser by itself, if you can't bring the actual produce, you exchange it for money, bring it to Jerusalem, and spend it there, and buy whatever it is that you desire. Now, why is that an important case for our discussion? Because there's one detail of that exchange, of what we call the pidyon, the exchange of the fruit for money, that's not in the first source, but it appears in Vayikra. It says, "Vim gaol yigal ish mi maaser." This is the second source on the page. If a man will redeem aught of his tithe, if somebody, in other words, actually does that process of redemption, of exchanging money for maaser, what does he do? V'yasaf chamishito yosef alav. You have to add 1/5. In other words, it's not a 1-for-1 ratio of exchange here, right? It's not that I figure out that the value of my produce is X number of shekels, and I exchange it for exactly that number of shekels. What I do is I add 1/5 of the value that I have estimated, or that has been estimated, let's say, and I bring the produce plus 1/5 of its value to Yerushalayim, and that's the money that I spend in Yerushalayim on all of the things that were listed in the previous pasuk. So in other words, it would seem that there's something of a penalty almost for exchanging it for money. Ideally, you bring the fruit. If you can't bring the fruit, you exchange it for money, bring it to Yerushalayim, but if you do that, understand that you have to pay an additional 20% in order to have the right to do that. Now, ready? Here's where the fun begins. The last source on the first page is a Mishnah from Masechet Maaser Sheni. There's an entire tractate of the Mishnah that deals with the various laws, the details of the Maaser Sheni, of the tithe. And this particular Mishnah deals with this question. Ma'arimi ma'aser sheni ketzad. I'm going to just read you the English that I have here. One may contrive regarding Maaser Sheni, how so? Let me first a comment on the English translations. I did not do these English translations myself. I took them from whatever was available on the internet. So you're going to find certain words that are translated inconsistently, and I'm just going to remind you that this English word means the same thing as that English word, or we'll just bring it back to the Hebrew word that we're going to introduce in a few seconds from now. But I tried to put as much English as I could onto these pages. You'll see not every source is translated, but wherever I could find a translation, I put it there. I'm just saying that to understand that the English is inconsistent, and we're going to see the same Hebrew word translated, I think, at least 3 different ways in these various sources. So, the first Hebrew word is ma'arimim. Ma'arimim, what does that mean? So the English here says, one may contrive. What that essentially means is, one may come up with a way to pull off a fast one, to trick, regarding the Maaser Sheni. What's the trick regarding the Maaser Sheni? Well, the question is, how do I get out of that 20% penalty, that 1/5 additional money that I have to pay when I'm exchanging my produce for cash? How do I get out of that? Well, the Mishnah is going to give us some acceptable tricks. And the Mishnah uses that word ma'arimim. And I just want to talk about that word for half a second. Again, we'll see in a few minutes the way the Rambam addresses that word. But that word ma'arimim is the basis of most of our discussion tonight. If you look at the subheading of this whole section, it says ha'arama. Ha'arama are what I called here halachically sanctioned tricks. So the word ma'arim means one may perform ha'arama, which means one may come up with a trick to avoid paying that extra 1/5 penalty when exchanging their ma'aser for money. Yes?
The connotation of contrive is negative.
Okay, good. So I didn't put this on the sheet because but there's a whole discussion here about the nomenclature and the use of the word l'ha'arim. I'll just give you an example. This week, we just read Parshas Noach, right? If you go back an extra week, we read Parshas Bereishis, And there is a pretty negative character in Parshas Bereishis who is described as Arom. Who is?
Snake.
The snake. Good. So it says, V'hanachash haya Arom mikol chayat ha-sadeh. The snake was the most cunning, the slyest of all of the creatures of the field that Hashem had created. So straight away, that word in the Torah seems to have a negative connotation. And the Rambam is going to give us a nomenclature that we're going to see pretty soon, and other people are not entirely thrilled with the Rambam's nomenclature, because you see, if you go through Tanakh, the word that root, ayin resh mem, tends to appear in a negative way. Nevertheless, it also appears, if you look at the translation of Unkelus, so in another place where a similar word appears, and we'll see that similar word soon, the word is mirma. Okay, Rambam is going to make a distinction between harama and mirma. We'll get to it soon. But the word mirma, when it appears in the Torah, it says when Yaakov's sons were trying to fool the city of Shechem into getting circumcised so that when they were weak from the circumcision, they could go and essentially attack the town. So when it says b'mirma, the translation of Unkelus is b'chuchmita, which is Aramaic. Chuchmita sounds like what Hebrew word? Chachma, exactly. So it means being smart, outsmarting people, right? So essentially... True. So it wasn't a good thing that they did, but the translation of the word chuchmata, right, the translation of the word just kind of gives us an idea that what this is all about, mirma or harama, assuming that, I mean, they're not interchangeable, we'll see, but, and again, like I said, it kind of confounds or perturbs some of the commentaries on the Mishnah, but it implies at least that there's some degree of creativity here, there's some degree of intelligently sidestepping some of the major issues, including, well, let's just say the major issue, right? The Torah says do X, and you're finding a creative way not to do X. Now, what's interesting here is that the Mishnah is prescribing for us how to do that. The Mishnah is clearly telling us, this is a way to do it. You want to get out of paying the fifth? You want to get out of that 20%? I'll tell you exactly how to do it. So listen to what the Mishnah says. Marim ma'matzer sheni ketzad. We can contrive. We can have ha'arama when it comes to Maaser Sheni. How, asks the Mishnah? Well, here's your trick. Omer Adam levno ulevito hagadolim, la'avdo l'shevchato ha'ivrim, heilach ma'ot elu. A person may say to his adult son or daughter, or to his Jewish slave or maidservant, as our translation says, here is money, take this money, upedei lecha Maaser Sheni zeh, and redeem this Maaser Sheni for yourself. What does that mean? What that essentially means is, if I redeem my own Maaser Sheni for myself, I have to pay the penalty. I have to pay the 20%. But if somebody else redeems my Maaser Sheni, they don't have to pay it. So what do? I give money to, again, it talks about my adult children or my Jewish servants, because if it's my minor children or my non-Jewish servants, then they're not really doing it for themselves, right? A child doesn't have agency, according to halacha. A slave, a non-Jewish slave, doesn't have agency. So if I give them the money and I say, you do this, that doesn't really work, right? But if I give it to a Jewish servant or to an adult child and I say, here's some money, go and redeem the maaser sheni, since it's not their maaser that they're redeeming, they don't have to pay the extra fifth. And presumably, somehow, that'll make it back into my possession at some point. So that is the question.
And all that kind of stuff, but it still, like, really seems like where do they come off?
So that is going to be one of the important questions that we're going to deal with tonight. One of the important questions is, where does the Mishnah come off doing it, giving us a prescription for essentially sidestepping what the Torah says we're supposed to do? Right? In fact, the Chassam Sofer, I didn't put this source here, but I don't think I did. Maybe I did. The Chassam Sofer... Let me just see if I gave you the source here. On the back of the page. We're not going to look at it now. I'll just tell you what he says. I'll just tell it to you outside. And towards the end, we'll look at it. The Rabbi Moshe Sofer, the Chassam Sofer, 18th century, Hungary, one of the great, early I don't say early Orthodox. What I mean is, like, he's one of the people who helped the Orthodox movement come up with its identity when Reform was breaking away. But he's, like, you know, one of the great gedolim of the last few centuries. The Chassam Sofer is one of the towering figures. So he has a lengthy, lengthy discussion of this topic. And in the discussion, when he reads this Mishnah, he says, you know, when I read this Mishnah, I don't see the Mishnah talking as if, like, listen, it's going to happen anyway, so we might as well just, you know, figure out what's, you know, what happens if people do it. He says it sounds from the Mishnah, the language of the Mishnah sounds like the Mishnah is speaking about this in a positive way. In other words, you go ahead, please do it. That's the way the Chassam Sofer reads the Mishnah. And you're right, so it sounds strange. So the question is, why are you allowed to do it? So like I said, that's going to be one of the defining questions that we have to deal with here. Yeah.
Can you just explain?
Right. So if I want to bring the money to...
Then it's got to be 120.
Right.
So
if I redeem it for myself, it's 120. If my child redeems it, it's 100. If a person who is not me...
So the farmer himself will not...
Well, maybe they'll give it back to him and then he'll go to Yerushalayim. Maybe they'll, you know, et cetera, et cetera. That's why it's a loophole. In other words, ultimately it's going to benefit him. He's the one who's going to end up in Yerushalayim, but he's not the one doing the actual exchange of the produce for the money. So that's where it's a loophole. Because somebody else is doing the exchange, but he's the one who's going to benefit from it. Huh? So it seems like he's not transferring ownership. It seems like he's just telling that, but he's letting the other person do the exchange, and that is what makes it happen. Where? Wherever. No, you're exchanging it for yourself. In other words, you have to bring the produce to Yerushalayim. The alternative is for, if you can't bring the produce, is for you to exchange it for your own money and to bring your money to Yerushalayim. In other words, once you exchange it, you can now eat your grapes at home, right? Again, the example that might have been before you walked in, the example that we gave was a farmer who has, like, you know, a major harvest of grapes won't be able to get them all to Yerushalayim before they start to rot. So instead, he exchanges the value of the grapes for money. Now he could just sit back and eat those grapes at home, and the money goes with him to Yerushalayim, and that's where he buys all the stuff that he's going to eat in the city of Yerushalayim. That's the way Maaser Sheni works.
Oh, so he's just taking the money out of
there. Exactly. Taking it out of one pocket, putting it in the other, basically. Right. Okay, now, let's start with this question. Okay, so let's see what the Yerushalmi says. The Yerushalmi asks Betsy's question, but I'm not sure that we're going to like it as much. The answer of the Yerushalmi as much. We're going to have to wait till the end to get the real answer. Okay, but it's the first line on the back of the first page, on the second page. The Talmud Yerushalmi, again, I don't have a good English translation of the Talmud Yerushalmi. Luckily, it's in extra difficult Aramaic, so we're good. The Talmud Yerushalmi says, Rabbi Avon Amar Ispalgun Rabbi Lezer Rabbi Yossi Bar Chanina. Rabbi Avon says, why does this happen, right? Why is it that we could either exchange it or whatever? In other words, why does the Mishnah allow us to perform that trick that it said? So we're going to just look at one of the opinions. It says, Chad Amar Lama Marim Malav. Why is it that you're allowed to do that trick? Mipnei shekatuv bo bracha. Because bracha is written with regard to the Maaser Sheni. What does that mean? It means the way the Yerushalmi is interpreting the psukim that we looked at earlier. If you look at the end of the third pasuk that we look at, pasuk Chavdal 24, it says, Ki v'rechecha Hashem Elokecha, when Hashem your God will bless you. Now, we explained that before, and it's basic sense, in its simple sense, as meaning, if it's too hard for you to get to Yerushalayim because God blessed you and either you have a lot of produce or you live very far from Yerushalayim or whatever it is, right, that was the blessing. But the way the Yerushalmi is interpreting it is this, that there's a blessing associated with bringing money to Yerushalayim rather than with bringing the actual produce to Yerushalayim. That if you bring the money to Yerushalayim, then you get a bracha. If you bring the produce to Yerushalayim, you're fulfilling the halacha, you're doing what Hashem wants, but the bracha that the Torah talks about is not applicable to you. So the Yerushalmi says, why are you allowed to do this trick? You're allowed to do the trick because the bracha pertains. We want the bracha to apply to you. What does that mean?
Why wouldn't it apply if you brought the produce?
That's a good question. So,
you should do the trick.
Sorry?
Yeah.
It almost means you should do the trick. Very interesting. That's
isn't the exchange.
Giving
money to, let's say, your people serve it to paying 20%.
Right, exactly. So what it's saying in the Yerushalmi is we would rather people bring money to Yerushalayim than bring fruit to Yerushalayim. That's essentially, it seems to be, what the Yerushalmi is saying. And So the trick would only apply to people who do the exchange, because for some reason we prefer money coming to Jerusalem than preferring the fruit to come to Yerushalayim, for whatever reason. Yeah, John.
So why is the Torah at all talking about a 20% increase?
Because okay. Good question. Putting that aside for a moment. In theory, if you're not bringing the actual fruit, you should pay the 20%. What we're saying is that since we want the money to make it there, or there's bracha, and I shouldn't say we want the money to make it there, there's bracha involved to people who bring the money, therefore we allow you to do that trick in order to maximize the possibility that the money will be brought rather than the possibility that the fruit itself will be brought. Yeah. Right, so it's a good question. So again, it could be related to the fact that at certain points it was better to bring money to Yerushalayim than it was to bring produce to Yerushalayim, and at other points it was better to bring produce than to bring money. We're going to take a look at that little excerpt from the Chassam Sofer at the end.
So you're saying it's okay to bring less money?
They are saying it's okay. Well, no, what they're saying is this. More money will come if we waive the 20%, or if we figure out a way around the 20%. Listen, you can't waive the 20%, right? And by the way, that's important. It's important to point out that the rabbis don't just say, well, why don't we just waive the 20%? Assuming that it's true that we want more people to bring money than to bring produce, nowhere do the rabbis say, so we'll just waive the 20%. Instead, what they say is, you have to come up with this creative way of getting around paying the 20%, rather than just waiving it and saying goodbye 20%, everybody just bring the one-for-one value of your fruit to Yerushalayim. That's an important point that I'm going to get to at the end also. But I guess I will just put it out there for you, right? That we're going to see in all these halachic tricks, and we'll see this as we go on the next week we're going to talk about this in a little bit more detail. The rabbis don't just sort of creatively come up with ways of abolishing Torah laws. Sometimes, you know, they have ways, and there are discussions in the Gemara about whether the rabbis have the ability to abolish Torah law, don't have the ability to abolish Torah law, but in general, in terms of like making big decrees, big takanot, that will somehow render void some portion of the Torah, that doesn't happen generally. Instead, they rely upon these mechanisms that keep the Torah law while kind of sidestepping it. And that's a very, very important point for us to bear in mind, because it shows you the way the rabbis think about it. They're not just saying, we're going to wholesale dispense with certain things that, listen, you know, we see a need to dispense and so we dispense, but instead they're saying we have to continue to function within the framework. That's important. Like I said, we'll get to that. That's kind of something we're going to sit on a little bit next week when we look at the Prusbul. In any case, that's our first example for the mission. That's the example of the Maaser Sheni. Now, the second example that I gave you is a little bit more esoteric, and I'm going to move through it a little bit more quickly, and it's the example of the firstborn animal. The reason that I'm giving you that example is because it's the only other time in the Mishnah that the Mishnah seems to actively advocate for sidestepping the Torah law or coming up with a way around something the Torah says. So here's what the Torah says. In Vayikra, the Torah says, "Ach b'chor asher yivukar la'Hashem ba'beheima lo yakdish ishoto." Any kind of firstborn animal which is born as a firstling to the Lord, no man shall sanctify it. Should we translate the English into English? If you have a b'chor, firstborn animal that's born, you can't make that animal into a korban. You can't make it into a sacrifice. Why? Because the Bechor is its own category of Kedusha, its own category of holiness, so therefore you can't take it and make it into anything else, it has to be treated as a Bechor. Okay. Having said that, the third source on the second sheet gets right into the question, Ketzer Ma'arim Ma'ala Bechor. Okay, now that you tell me, the Torah tells me that the Bechor, the firstborn animal, cannot be used for anything other than the firstborn animal. Let's say I want to use it as a sacrifice. How do I do that? I'll tell you, says the Mishnah, here's a device that you could use in order to turn that Bechor into a sacrifice. And it says, if we have a firstborn animal that... Let me say this. Mevakeret Shaitam Uberet. You have an animal that's going to give birth to its firstborn child. Omer, a person can say, Mashe b'me'eha shel zo im zachar ola. The owner of the animal could say, that which is in the womb of this animal that's pregnant, if it's male, it will be an ola, it'll be a burnt offering. Now, the Mishnah continues, Yalda zachar yikarev ola v'im nekeva zevach shlamim. I wonder if this one on the Mishnah here. So it says, if it turns out to be a male, then he brings it as an ola, and if it turns out to be a female, he could bring it as a shlamim. A shlamim is a different category of sacrifice. For our purposes, we're not going to spend a lot of time on that. Yelda nekeva tekarev shlamim. There's something wrong with the text here, right? It's kind of repetitive and going around in circles. Yeah. Okay, fine. There's something wrong with whatever it is that the Hebrew here somehow came out strange. Okay, in any case, so the Mishnah says a person could say if it's a male, it's going to be an ola. If it's a female, it's going to be a shlamim. The point is that you can make the animal into a korban when it's still within the mother. That's, again, here's our loophole, right? The loophole is that once the animal comes out, then it's considered a bechor. But as long as it's still inside the mother, it's not considered a bechor. And until it's considered a bechor, the rules of bechor don't apply to it. So that until the rules of bechor apply to it, you can devote it, you can sanctify it, and dedicate it as a different kind of korban, so that when it's born, it'll serve that purpose. And the Gemara goes even further. The Gemara says, this is in that fourth source on that page, Rabbi Huda says, Mutar lahatil mum bebechor kodem sheyetze lavir ha'olam. Not only can I dedicate it as a korban, I could actually reach into the mother, and before the animal comes out, I can blemish it. Why? What happens when it's blemished? It can't be as a korban, and it doesn't have the sanctity of bechor anymore, right? And then it's mine. So the Gemara doesn't like this. The Gemara says, Tanan. The Mishnah says, a person can make it into a Omer adam mashe bebe'eha shel zu ola ola. Ola in shlamim lo, right? So it says a person could sanctify it and make it into an ola, but if it becomes but the male animal could be an ola and not a shlamim. An ola is a higher level of sanctity. A shlamim is a lower level of sanctity. So if it comes out male, it could only be that level of sanctity. So the Gemara is basically saying, listen, the Mishnah just said you could make it into a different kind of sanctity when it's inside the mother, but you can't lower its level of sanctity. But now you, va'at amar demasis mafkas lemikdushasa, and you're saying that we could just remove it from its sanctity altogether. Amar lachav Yehuda hani mili bezmacha besa mikdash kayam. When is it that you could make it into a different kind of sanctity, but not remove its sanctity altogether? When the besa mikdash exists, but ki kamina ana, when I say that you can remove its sanctity altogether, that's bezman hazeh delo chazi lahakrava. That's talking about our times when it cannot be brought as a sacrifice. In any case, what the Mishnah and the Gemara are telling us here, when it comes to the firstborn animal, again, straight away, the Mishnah is saying, here are the list of devices that you can use in order to try to remove the sanctity of a Bechor so that it won't be considered a Bechor any longer. Okay? Once again, we see that same thing. The Torah says, you have to treat this animal in manner X. The rabbis come along and say, we're now going to tell you a lot of ways that you can, or some ways that you can make sure that the animal is not treated in way X. Now the Rambam in his commentary on the Mishnah gives us a little bit of explanation. It's the last source on the second page. And the Rambam says, Karnet ba'er ba'ferush ba'Torah. The Torah says clearly, Sh'asur lahakdish b'chor lamizbeach, k'mosh b'arna b'shmini da'arachim. In the eighth parak of Arachim, we explain that you're not allowed to make a b'chor into a sacrifice. The b'chor is only a b'chor. However, says the Rambam, Ubaba Kabbalah, Kabbalah in this case means Torah Shebaal Peh, it doesn't mean mysticism. We have a tradition that you are allowed to sanctify a firstborn animal as long as it's still inside the mother. The Kach Hamruba Sifra, Asher Yivukar LaHashem LeYakdish Isho, he quotes a Sifra, which is an early Midrash that says, if it was firstborn, then you're not allowed to sanctify it. And the Sifra says, Mishi Yivukar Iyata Makdisho. When it is born and it's a firstborn, then you're not allowed to sanctify it, to make it into a korban. But you can make it into a korban when it's still inside the mother. That's the first part of the Rambam. So he just explains that the sanctity of Bechor does not apply until it comes into the world. Yeah, Jim.
One observation is this device is self-contained, whereas the first one, the 20%, uses a shliach, so to speak.
Okay, interesting.
Right, this one is really just on the person himself.
So that's okay. So it's an interesting question. So it's true the person himself is doing it. Okay, that's an interesting point. But even in the first case, it would seem that the beneficiary is the person himself, right? So that's So here you're the beneficiary, there you're the beneficiary. It just happens to be that the device is different, right? That here, the device is, you make it into a korban before it comes out of the mother. There, the device is, you get somebody else to exchange it for money for you. Either way, though, the ultimate beneficiary is there, you're not paying the 20%. Here, you could use the animal for something else. In other words, the whole idea of making the animal into a korban is if you have to bring a korban for whatever purpose, now you have an animal that you could use for a korban, which previously you would not have been allowed to do. Right? So that's something. Now, I got into this nomenclature question before. This is the last line of that second page where the Rambam introduces a division, a distinction here. It says, V'hatachbula hamuteret, the tachbula, again, a trick, which is permissible, nekret ha'arama, v'she'ena muteret mirma. That which is allowed is called ha'arama. That which is not allowed is called mirma. Now again, this is where the commentaries get a little crazy, trying to see where that applies. But what's important for us from the Rambam is that the Rambam is already telling us that there are some tricks that are permissible, and there are some tricks that are not permissible. So here we took two examples of things that the Torah clearly said were not permissible, and the rabbis tell you, well, here are ways that we're going to make it permissible. Now I'm going to let you in on an itty-bitty secret when it comes to the Maser Sheni. There are Gemaras that try to show that it's Maser Sheni, which only applies to Rabbanan and not to Oraita, so the Harama only applies to Oraita. So like one of the issues that I decided not to get into is a lengthy discussion, a lengthy machlokas between the poskim, which goes back even to the interpretation of Gemaras, as to whether these tricks only work on rabbinic laws or whether they work on Torah laws also. It would seem that they work on Torah laws, but some people try to show how even the tricks that seem to pertain to Torah laws are really only rabbinic. But again, a lot of the postgame, including the Chasam Sofer, who, like I said, wrote this very lengthy and convincing piece on this topic, says, no, it even works according to Torah law. You could even do Harama to get out of a Torah law, like the Bechor, like the Maser Sheni, even if they apply according to the Torah. Yeah, John. Okay. Okay, so let's start with this. I'm going to take the second part of your question and answer that first, and then I'll go back to the first part. The second part of your question was whether they apply consistently to Chok HaMishpat. A better way of answering that question is, do they apply consistently? Period. That same piece from the Chasam Sofer, something I didn't give you here, he has like a one-liner. I didn't want to stick it on the sheet. It's just sort of like four words within a line, in which the Chasam Sofer says, if you go through the Talmud and you try to figure out consistently how to apply the laws of Harama, the laws of these loopholes and these creative tricks, you're not going to find a consistent way of applying it. You'll find some cases when it's okay, you'll find some cases when it's not okay, and what I'm about to show you is that even the cases that, some cases that seem like they could be okay are not okay, and even some cases that seem like they are not okay, or the rabbis say explicitly are not okay, are more okay than it might seem, and we're going to get to that in just a moment. So the point is that the question of do they apply consistently to X or Y or Z, so the Chasam Sofer already says, it's very hard to find consistent application of these laws at all. He's not the only one who says that. Other people say, you know, that you can't, and some of the Rishonim, even before him, say, you can never use one example of Harama and say, ah, since we have this example, that shows us that you could do it in other cases as well, because it's applied on a case-by-case basis and not with any specific set of criteria, which is very unusual in halacha, and I think in any legal system, to say we apply this on a case-by-case basis rather than giving you a set of tools that you could apply and or a test that you could use to see, is this okay or is this not okay? Although, like I said, we'll see as we proceed that there is sort of an underlying idea here or a reason for the acceptability. Okay, so let's look at the next page. I put some other examples. I thought of giving you a lot of examples, but now I realize that would be crazy. So I gave one other example. The examples that we looked at previously are cases from the Mishnah, which take what seem to be Torah laws and seem to give you the tools for subverting or for contravening a Torah law. There are also a lot of rabbinic laws throughout the halacha. A lot of them have to do with preparing food on Shabbos and Yom Tov. It probably won't surprise you to hear, because again, there are a lot of questions as to what is acceptable, what's not acceptable. So the next couple of examples we're going to look at, both an acceptable one and a not acceptable one, have to do with preparing food on Shabbos, or actually preparing food on Yom Tov. Like I said, there are a lot of examples of preparing food on Shabbos. I only gave you one because it's one that's interesting. So here's what it is. This is the top source on the third page. It says, Rabbi Yehuda quotes Shmuel, Moleach adam kama chatichot basar bebat achat, af al pi she'eino tzarech el chaticha achas. A person can salt a lot of pieces of meat at one shot, even though that person only needs a single piece of meat. To make a very long story very short. Actually, you know what? The English that I gave you here is from Steinsaltz, so he elaborates on it a little bit, right? So Rabbi Yehuda said that Shmuel said, a person may salt on a festival several pieces of meat at one time, although he requires only one piece, as it is all one act of salting. That's Rabbi Yehuda in the name of Shmuel. Right, so the important point coming out of the Steinsaltz commentary is that we're talking about Yom Tov here. Right? We're talking about a person who is salting meat, presumably for use on Yom Tov, but presumably also more than you're going to conceivably eat on Yom Tov. Right? That's an important point. But the next line of the Gemara is what's important. Rav Ada bar Ahava ma'arim u'malach garma garma. Rav Ada bar Ahava had a trick, which would, again, Steinsaltz's translation of Harama is artifice. So far we've seen contrivance and artifice, and other things, devices. That's the three English translations we've seen so far. Well, I think device is neutral, and are they translated into anything? So we're not telling you, that's exactly the point. The point is we're not telling you to do something wrong. What we're telling you is, we'll see as we get along what exactly it is that we're telling you to do. That's good. We're building to what exactly it is that we tell you to do. But first, we're going to have to see what we tell you not to do. But so the Gemara said, but by the way, parenthetically, I'm going to get to that in a second. So Rav Ada bar Ahava says, or not says, the Gemara says that Rav Ada bar Ahava would salt one limb at a time, essentially, using this harama. What did he do? If you look at Rashi, and I didn't give it to you on the sheet, it says that he would salt one piece, then he would say, oh, maybe I'm going to eat that piece. And he would salt that piece. And say, hey, you know what? Maybe I'm going to eat that piece. So he would salt that piece. So each time, the piece that he was salting was the piece that he was going to use for Yom Tov, right? Because presumably, you could only salt what you need for the Chag, right? You can't do more than that. Otherwise, you have problems with preparing on Yom Tov. So Rav Ada would pick up each piece and say, maybe I like this one better, and salt it. Maybe I like that one better, and salt it. Maybe I like this one better, and salt it. Now, it's in cases like this. We're going to see soon, actually, towards the end, we're going to see the rush. But already this example of Rav Ada bar Ahava, so the commentaries start getting into, does this apply to everybody? Can anybody just do this? And there are other examples of these ha'aramot, of these devices. I like the translation of device. Of these devices where the Gemara will say, you know what? We only let a Talmud Chacham do this. In other words, there are times that the Gemara is afraid that if we sort of give people the, blanket permission, free reign to do it, then it's going to lead to a mistreatment of Yom Tov. So Gail, it's sort of an answer to your question, are we saying to do the wrong thing? So the answer is what we're saying is that within the halacha there are ways to function and to come up with these sort of, sidesteps. And the real question that some of the rabbis deal with is, should everyone be allowed to do that? Or should it only be, should permission only be given to people who are great scholars or extra pious? Because we know that those people are not going to ever go beyond what is permitted, and that's something that we'll see again in a few minutes. That's always a question.
I think we're seeing today that people, as you said in your speech on Shabbos, that people with power sometimes.
Right. So, okay, that's a good question. But again, sometimes this is more theoretical than practical. So in theory, it could be a Talmud Chacham who does it. Who exactly has the right to be called a Talmud Chacham? Maybe you need somebody outside to give you the go-ahead. I'm not sure.
Basically, you can just rely on your
own. Always. Right. So, what the question here is, how much can you rely on yourself? In other words, sometimes it says you can rely on your rabbi, sometimes it says a rabbi should only rely on himself and then shouldn't give permission to others. Again, we're going to see that in a few minutes. But roughly, yeah. I mean, the answer is, of course, the rabbi can make a determination as to who the rabbi feels is worthy, but then you're kind of giving too much too much subjective power to the rabbi, too much discretion to the rabbi, as it were, to decide you yes, you no. Oh yeah, yeah, for sure. The rabbi can make a decision. The rabbi can make a decision as to what he considers correct for his given community. Absolutely, yes. Okay, all of these are examples of things that are permitted. And again, we're going to have to see later on. This case seems to be a little strange, right? Rav Ada deciding, maybe I like this one, and maybe I like that one. Is that really okay? And the question is, how does that differ from another potential trick? And that's going to be the trick we're going to look at. What happens, and this is a more practical question, what about the case of Erev Tavshilin? Now, the Erev Tavshilin itself is kind of a trick, but within that trick, there are other potential tricks, because what the Mishnah is going to talk about is, what happens if somebody didn't make an Erev Tavshilin? Right, so let's look at what we have here. So this is our beginning our next section. We've looked now at sanctioned tricks. Now we're going to look at non-sanctioned tricks, or things that the Rambam would call mirma. So again, I put that on the sheet. Mirma, that's the way the Rambam describes it, so that's what we're going to look at now. Some tricks that are not sanctioned by halacha. Number one, and probably the most famous one, the greatest example of that, is the trick of what happens if a person doesn't have an Erev Tavshilin. So the Gemara in Masechet Beitza says, Tashma, quotes a Braita, if somebody prepared an Erev Tavshilin for the joining of cooked foods on a festival eve, that person, that person could bake and cook and insulate food. In other words, all of the steps of preparing food, you're allowed to do that on the festival in preparation of Shabbos, right? Now, the mission of the Gemara continues. And if you want to eat your Erev on Shabbos, obviously you could do that, right? If your Erev Tavshilin is gone, you ate the Erev Tavshilin before. So now your excuse or your device for being able to cook on Erev Shabbos in order to have food on Shabbos, that's gone. So the Gemara says, sorry, you now lost your ability to use the Erev Tavshilin. If the device is gone, then what the device accomplishes is also gone. So no baking, no cooking, no insulating, not for yourself, not for others. And the Gemara even says, V'lo acherim ofim uvashlin lo. Not only that, but others cannot cook or bake for you. But wait, says the Gemara, here we go. Aval, mevashel hu liyom tov, but you can cook for Yom Tov, right? Remember that the Erev Tavshilin is used on the second day of Yom Tov, or on Yom Tov that's leading into Shabbos, right? So you can cook for the holiday, v'im hotir l'Shabbos, right? In other words, you say, I want to have, brisket on Yom Tov afternoon, I'm going to make enough brisket to feed 15 people, even though there are only 5 people in my family. And then the 5 of us eat brisket, and miraculously there are 10 portions of brisket left over. Now I have food for Shabbos. Wow, how did that happen? Well, the Gemara says, if you cook too much, that's okay. But listen to what the Gemara concludes. Ubilvad shelo ya'arim v'im ha'arim aser. You can have leftovers that you eat on Shabbos, but you can't employ artifice. No devices, no trickery here. We're going to have to see in a second what that means. And if you did employ trickery, then you're not allowed to eat that food on Shabbos. Oh, okay. Now, so it sounds like if you don't have an Erev Tavshilin, your Erev Tavshilin is gone, right?
They made it, right?
So it sounds like you made some extra...
You made the bracha and everything?
Yeah, but it's gone.
It
only works when it's there, right? If it's not there, it doesn't work. So look, listen to what Rashi says, because Rashi is going to explain what is the ha'arama, what is the trick here involved with the Erev Tavshilin. So Rashi says, the trick is this, la'achar shebishel letzorech. What does it mean to employ a device or a trick in the context of the Erev Tavshilin? It means this. It means you cooked for Yontif, right? So there are 5 people in my family. I made a piece of brisket big enough to feed 5. I finished with that brisket. Then I'm like, oh, but wait a minute. What if some guests come in the afternoon of Yontif and I have to feed them, right? So listen to what Rashi says. So the achar, but it only applies, in other words, only after you finished cooking can you not then start cooking again with this excuse or with this trick of I'm cooking for potential guests, right? Lomar, oh, I still have to invite guests, v'vashel tavshilin acherim, and then you cook other foods, v'yotirem l'Shabbos, that's what you left over for Shabbos. However, Rashi says, aval b'kedera achat im yarbel l'Shabbos. That, he says, ha'amar da'afil l'chol shari. In other words, if you take one pot and you cook 15 pieces of meat, that's okay. But if you cooked five, and then after you cook the five, you go back and say, ooh, you know what? What if I cooked another 10 because I could potentially invite 10 guests this afternoon? That, Rashi says, is not okay. Yeah. So, but what Rashi says is, if you cook for 15 at the same time, as long as you're doing it, as long as it's combined with your yuntif food, you're okay. Even though you know, that's exactly what Rashi says. And so that's what I'm saying. The Gemara seems to say here in a blanket way, no tricks, right? No sidestepping the Erev Tavshilin. If you don't have one, you're done. Rashi is now kind of walking back from that a little bit and saying, only you're only done if you're trying to cook sort of like an independent dish. But if you incorporate it into what you're cooking for yuntif anyway, then it's okay. So yeah, if you know you have five people in your family and you cook 15 pieces of food, Rashi would say, as long as you do it all at the same time, you're good to go. It's only if you first cook the five and then you started tricking and saying, I could potentially have guests this afternoon, that's when the problems begin. Yeah, Jim?
It seems very arbitrary, I think, because you're not giving derivation of these quote-unquote tricks.
Okay.
Is it that they don't exist, or we're just not covering?
Interesting question. So the derivation generally does not exist. It's a logical, intellectual thing. Yes. There's an interesting question here, which is let's put it this way. The question is: do all tricks technically work, but sometimes you are not allowed to employ them, or is it sometimes they don't work? Right? Because it sounds to me at least a little bit like what the Gemara is saying here is: in theory, the trick would work, and the rabbis sort of made an extra rule saying you are not allowed to employ the trick here, but in theory the trick would work. So in terms of the derivation, there isn't. You see, this is not like your standard Gemara where it's going to go back and try to kind of trace it back to Pesukim generally. With the exception so far is that example of Maser Sheni with the Bracha that we're going to get back to in a minute. But generally, there isn't like an extensive background for each of these. It's more like case-by-case basis, like I was saying before. Yeah, Ben, you wanted to say something?
Simple, but you're not cooking any food for either yuntif or for Shabbos. You're taking a matzah and a hard-boiled egg. You're not going to eat the matzah or the hard-boiled egg on yuntif. You're supposed to eat it on Shabbos. Maybe you even forget to eat it on Shabbos. You know, it's not really your food.
Well,
it's outside food. That's a simple that says you can now cook food on yuntif for Shabbos. It's not even the food that you're going to use for Shabbos.
Well, in theory, it is food that you're going to use for Shabbos. If you cook that egg on Erev Yontif and you're going to eat that egg on Shabbos, that's your Shabbos food. No, I said, if you cook the egg on Erev Yontif, right? If you made that egg on Erev Yontif and your plan is to eat it on Shabbos, which is what your plan should be if you make an Erev Tavshilin, so then you made food for Shabbos on Erev Yontif. And that's where, so it's not so fake, it's not symbolic, it really is Shabbos food. It might not be your main dish that you're going to sit down to on Friday night, or it's not your chalent, but it's still a food that you cook for Shabbos.
But it's not kosher food, and why can't you cook it on Friday, which is a yuntif, for Shabbos? Why must it be Erev yuntif?
So again, that's part of the nature of what the Erev Tavshilin is all about. The reason that I gave this example, though, is just to show, first of all, the fact that the rabbis, under certain circumstances, say no tricking. And the fact that Rashi walks back from that to a certain extent, but that still, the no tricking is in place. We're going to see in the Shulchan Aruch in a second what that means. So I don't want to get too much into the Erev Tavshilin example, mainly because this is your worst nightmare, Ben. We are running a little bit, tight on time, so we can't get like into the full details of the Erev Tavshilin. But the answer is that the Erev Tavshilin is not symbolic. It is a trick, but it's not just a symbol. It really is your Shabbos food. If you cook food before Yontif to eat it on Shabbos, but the whole idea is that you have to have started before Yontif in order to be able to cook on Yontif for Shabbos. Now, why? Again, not for now. We're going to have to get into it another time. What I wanted to show you is some fascinating things from the Shulchan Aruch. Look at the Shulchan Aruch. These are the second to last source or third to last source on that page. The Shulchan Aruch says, "Im avar b'mezid." If a person did do this trick intentionally, or they did it accidentally, ubishel kama kaderos shelo tzarach yantiv, and you cooked many dishes that are not needed for yontiv, then he says, "Mutar la'ochlan b'Shabbos o b'chol." You're allowed to eat them on Shabbos. If you intentionally violated the halacha, then you are allowed to eat that food on Shabbos. But he says, "Imharim levashel beiz kederos l'tzorach." In other words, like this: if I cook on Friday, if it's Friday is yontiv, and I put up a pot of food and I say I am cooking this food for Shabbos, but I have no erev tavshilin, am I allowed to eat that food? So there he says, the Shulchan Aruch seems to say that you are. Right? But if I say, I don't have an Erev Tavshilin, so I'm going to cook for Yantif, quote unquote, right? I'm going to cook for my friends, quote unquote, who are not actually going to come. In other words, I try to employ a trick. Then, listen to what he says, Mherim Levashal Beiz Kaderos Atzarech Hayom, V'hotir Achas Atzarech Machar, and I left one over for tomorrow. Then the Shulchan Aruch says, Asr L'Ochla, you're not allowed to eat it. In other words, tricking is prohibited. Intentionally violating, the food is permissible. What's that all about? So look at the Shulchan Aruch, Mishnah Berurah, second to last source on the page. The Mishnah Berurah says, "De'ba'arama chayshinan shi'lamdu acherim la'asos kein v'gam hu yaseh kein pa'am acheres." In other words, the assumption is, "Masha ein kein b'mezid." If I violate on purpose, the assumption is I'm not going to be a chronic violator. I'm not going to always, you know, flout cooking for Shabbos when I don't have an Erev Tavshilin. Cooking ayanta for Shabbos when I don't have an Erev Tavshilin at all. Or when my Erev Tavshilin is gone. So it's not that it's okay to do, is that if you did it, what it's saying is, we don't tell you to throw out the food. That's what he's saying. Why? Because the assumption is that people don't want to consistently, intentionally violate the halacha. So if you did it this time, we let you get away with it. But if you try to trick, then we tell you you're not allowed to eat that food. Trick being that trick that we kept describing with the Erev Tavshilin. If you say, if first you cooked, and then you said, oh, maybe I'm going to invite some guests, then you cook again, so that's not okay. Why? So the Mishnah Berurah says, because in one case, it's black and white. You know that you did the wrong thing, and presumably you're not going to do it again. But in the other case, you kind of convince yourself that it's okay, and if you convince yourself that it's okay, then there's a greater chance of you or people who saw what you did being repeat offenders, and that's where the problem comes in. And so we're more cautious when it comes to ha'arama, when it comes to the attempt to trick, than we would be when it comes to actually violating. Yeah, Ben.
So is this also the basis for a person who forgets to make an Erev Tavshilin, and then he comes to the rabbi says, well, I made one for the whole community?
No, the basis of that is the fact that the rabbi makes one for the whole community. Right, so that's what it is, right, exactly. Although we generally tell people not to rely on that multiple times or whatever it is, right, only to rely on it once or whatever. Okay, anyhow, that's the example of the Erev Tavshilin. That's an example of where the rabbis say tricks are not allowed. Not allowed. One other example, this is where, again, this is sort of a gray area. This is another famous example, and this is going to be the last example of a case that we look at. The Gemara says, the attempt to avoid maaser. I'm just going to tell it to you outside. The Gemara says, or we can do the English on the back page, that Rabbi Bar Chana says, quoting Rabbi Yochanan, that he says, come and see that the later generations are not like the earlier generations. In earlier generations, people would bring their fruit into their courtyards through the main gate so that they would be obligated to give maaser. But in later generations, people bring their fruit through the roofs and through the courtyards and through enclosed courtyards to avoid having to give maaser. And essentially, what he's saying is this. The way you bring the food into your house determines whether you have to tithe that food or not. If you bring it in through the door, then you have to tithe. If you bring it in through the window, if it comes down your chimney, well, then you got a present. Because then you don't have to tithe the food. Again, these are all part of tricks. And Rabbi Bar Chana says, look at how terrible it is that people do this. So he's not saying that it's usur on one hand. On the other hand, he is saying that it's pretty terrible. I just want to run through this rush, the second source on this page, because he summarizes the approaches to harama. He says this. This is what I was saying before. Lo kol harama b'mili d'rabanan shavin. Not every kind of harama is equal to every other kind of harama. Yesh harama shemutar l'chol adam. There are some kind of tricks that are universally permissible. Everybody's allowed to do that. His example is the example of Rav Ada, who used to salt one piece at a time and say, maybe I want this one. He says, Yesh harama d'lo sharia el l'tzor v'merabanan. There are some kinds of tricks that are only permissible to scholars, to Talmidei Chachamim. The Yesh harama d'asur l'chuli alma. There are some examples of tricks that are universally prohibited. V'achmura barabanan t'femi mezid. And the rabbis are stricter when it comes to those tricks than they are with intentional violators, like the example of the Erev Tavshilin, like we saw. Right? He says, V'yesh ika plukta. There are some about which the rabbis are So what I'm trying to show you is that there are different kinds of tricks, there are different kinds of ha'aramot, and they apply under different circumstances. Now, having said that, now that we've introduced tricks that are okay, tricks that are not okay, the maaser sheni, the bechor, the salting of the meat, the erev tavshilin, which we said is not okay, the question is, what is this all about? Let's get back to Betsy's question from the very beginning. Why? Why would the rabbis condone trickery? Why would the rabbis, Gail, like you said, tell us that you could essentially do something which is not okay? So the answer is this. Let's take the example of the salting of the meat on Yantif, right? Here we have Rav Ada, who was a pretty big and important rabbi, who would salt a piece of meat and say, maybe I want to eat this one. Ah, no. Salt another piece of meat and say, maybe I want to eat that one. Why was he allowed to do that? Why is that different than tricking with the Erev Tavshilin, right? Because it's still preparing more on Yom Tov, using a trick to prepare food on Yantif that you're not going to eat on Yantif. So how is that different than a person who wants to do that same trick with the Erev Tavshilin? So, the Gemara says, I'll tell you what the difference is. It's the third to last source on the back page, and I'm just going to go from the underlined part. So he says this. I think the answer is this. The haramot, the hacha, these tricks, the tricks of salting multiple pieces of meat, hainu dafka b'dvarim shahahefseid balahem machmat simchas yom tov v'shalom machmas pshiyato. The reason that you would be suffering a loss, right? The reason that you're trying to trick it all when it's coming to salting the multiple pieces of meat is this. The person presumably wanted to have fresh meat on Yantif back in the days before refrigeration. So they slaughtered an animal to eat it on Yantif. But they could only eat a limited quantity of that meat on Yantif. So, what's happening here? What's happening here is you have a person who wants to celebrate Yom Tov in the best possible way by having good, fresh food. But what's going to happen is, as a result of the person wanting to celebrate Yantif in the best possible way, they're going to actually incur a major financial loss. And so the Gemara says, in that case, this is what Rashba's explanation, Rabbi Shimshon ben Avraham, Rashba says, in that case, we allow you to... No, Rashba's not Shimshon. Sorry, that's Rashba Mishans. Put it aside for a second. Shlomo ben Avraham. In that case, we allow you to salt the multiple pieces of meat because you're essentially fulfilling the mitzvah of enjoying Yom Tov. And fulfilling a mitzvah should not cause you to lose out. But when it comes to the Erev Tavshilin, you'd be losing because you did something wrong. You were the one who didn't put the Erev Tavshilin up, and you're the one who's trying to make trickery to try to get around the fact that you didn't put up the Erev Tavshilin. But in this case, you didn't do anything wrong at all. It was a circumstance, you're a victim of circumstance, and the combination of the circumstances with the fact that you actually want to perform a mitzvah, the mitzvah being celebrating Yom Tov in the right way, that's what allows us to allow you to employ a trick under those circumstances. So what Rashba is saying, or Shlomo ben Avraham, what he's saying is, when do we allow tricks? We allow tricks when there are two competing halachic values here. We have the halachic value of not preparing on Yom Tov for after Yom Tov, which is why in theory you would not be allowed to salt the other pieces of meat. But coming up against that is we have the halacha of Simchat Yom Tov, the fact that you're supposed to enjoy Yom Tov and celebrate it in the best way possible. And when two halachic values come to head with each other, then we have to try to figure out a way to make the two of those halachic values coexist. And so we allow the ha'arama. We don't abolish the halacha that you're not allowed to prepare on Yom Tov for after Yom Tov on one hand. But on the other hand, we allow you within the halacha to figure out a way to still celebrate Yom Tov, to, in other words, to actualize the other halacha.
No.
So we're saying if somebody forgot to do an Erev Tavshilin, they still have to suffer the consequences. Because there they did something wrong. The salt in the meat is a different... It's not for Shabbos. No. It's not related to the Erev Tavshilin. So again, in the case of the Erev Tavshilin, is you're trying to employ a trick to get out of when you know you're not supposed to. In this case, what we're saying is you didn't do anything wrong. It's just the circumstances that made you do it. And since the other value is celebrating Yom Tov, well, that's that. Now, that idea of there being another halachic value, that's something we could apply to the Maaser Sheni example also. What is this whole business of bracha, right? So Chassam Sofer says something fascinating. He says, the whole point is this, right? I don't want to read the whole thing inside because we really are running low on time. Chassam Sofer says maybe the whole idea of exchanging the maaser for money is so that a person can have bracha. In other words, the Torah's value is for people to have bracha. The Torah wants you to get that bracha. And since we want to maximize the number of people who can get that bracha, we come up with a device to allow the maximum number of people to bring money rather than fresh fruit to Yerushalayim in order to maximize the number of people who are being blessed. In other words, let's say it a little differently. What the Chassam Sofer seems to be saying is that there are two needs here. One need is a need to fulfill what the Torah says of paying the 20% when you exchange it. The other need is to actually realize and to fulfill what that mitzvah is all about, which is the maximum attainment of bracha. And if the maximum attainment of bracha requires us to figure out a way to circumvent what the Torah says with regard to the 20%, then, says Chasam Sofer, we would allow you to do that, because that's really realizing what the Torah's objective is when the Torah says, Ki Yivarecha Hashem Elokecha, the whole point of exchanging it for money is to achieve bracha. In other words, again, what we have is two good things, two important values coming up against each other. We have the value of following the letter of the halacha, what the Torah says, which is, make sure that you pay the 20% when you exchange the maser for money. Coming up against what the Torah says, which is, we want you to bring the money to Yerushalayim in order to achieve bracha. And when you have those two Torah values that are coming up against each other, the question is, what do we do? Do we abolish one and fulfill the other? Do we fulfill one and abolish the other? The Chasam Sofer says, that's why under those circumstances, the rabbis tell you, here's a trick you can use. Because they want to make sure that you could try to do both things. Not abolish or nullify the halacha on one hand, but on the other hand, maximize the number of people who can get bracha. And that's really what these tricks are all about. When we talk about tricks, what we're really talking about is figuring out a way to make sure that the Torah itself can be fulfilled. And when one Torah value somehow comes up against another Torah value, we have to try to figure out how to make those values coexist with each other. And especially when there's a need, when it's addressing something that society needs or that the Jewish people need on a broad level, we try to make sure that we can fulfill as many of those needs as possible. I just want to conclude with one fascinating example from the Yerushalmi. It's the last line of the page. Yerushalmi says, talks about Rabbi Tarfon. And it asks, it's in the context of marriages. Are you allowed to come up with these sort of, I don't want to call them sham marriages. Let's call them marriage as a device. Let's say it that way. Okay? So the Gemara asks, Mahu l'ha'arim? And it says, V'chi Rabbi Tarfon, Avien shel kol Yisrael lo ha'arim? Did Rabbi Tarfon, the father of all Israel, not engage with a device? Rabbi Tarfon presumably was a Kohen, and there was a famine, and he was still getting his truma. So what did he do? He knew that the truma can only be eaten by a Kohen and a Kohen spouse. So he got himself a lot of spouses. He married, as he didn't marry, he betrothed 300 women so that he could feed them all truma. Presumably he didn't fully marry. It was his kiddush, right? So I don't know if he married or what. But the point is, right, what's happening here? Rabbi Tarfon is seeing an important need that the Jewish people have at that time. You have people who need to be fed. He has the ability to feed them, but there is a halachic obstacle, as it were, but there's a way over the obstacle, or under it, or around it, or whatever it is. And so Rabbi Tarfon employs ha'arama, he employs a trick in order to make sure that the halacha is observed while the social need of the people is being met. And that's sort of the bottom line of this harama. It's not just sort of doing away with halachot, and it's not just finding a way around halachot, but it's utilizing creative ways to take two values that come up against each other, or that may contradict with each other, or that may conflict with each other, figuring out how to make them coexist in order to maximize facility for the Jewish people. The next year is a direct outgrowth of that. It's going to be about the Peruz Bowl and how Hillel may or may not have abolished the law of Shemitah Ksafim, of Shemitah canceling all debts. The question is, how did he do that? Why did he do that? What mechanism did he use to do that? Tune in next week.